Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Keck Centre and also to the Convention Centre in Baltimore, where we have our simulcast in the lobby of the EMS Today conference. We have a bit of an interesting day today. We're going to be jockeying back between the Keck Centre in Washington here at the National Academies and also the Baltimore Convention Centre, where we have our simulcast setting. We'll be running recordings of today's episode, today's activities, over at the Baltimore Convention Centre Thursday, Friday and Saturday, and that material will be available online. Without further ado, I'd like to formally thank the National Academies for making it possible for us to meet here in this fashion, both physically on-site and off-site and virtually and via recording. It's a wonderful facility that we have to be able to do that. I'm sitting here in the Keck Centre in Washington, and I'm just going to hand you all over to Baltimore's EMS Today Convention Centre, where Kyle Bates is going to give us an introduction to the one and only AJ Heitman. Over to you, Kyle.
Good morning, Nadine. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to EMS Today at Baltimore, Maryland. I'm here with AJ Heitman, and I'm going to make this quick and short and hand him over the microphone right now.
Thank you, Kyle, and good morning to everyone and to the National Academies. Thank you for joining us at EMS Today. We certainly want to welcome all of our international guests and all of our local guests that are here watching this live at EMS Today. And I'll tell you that you're missing a great overcast day in Baltimore, so it's a great day to be in educational sessions. It's a pleasure for us to be a part of this event. And we certainly welcome everybody on board to the National Academy Transportation Research Board Safety Systems Strategy Solutions Summit. We're pleased to have it in conjunction with our conference this year, expanded to also cover topics on terrorism and disaster preparedness. So it's an exciting time for us. The image that you see up there is a portly fellow who is very excited about having this be a part of EMS Today. I've been a very staunch fan of the National Academies and all of the work that's going on. As you'll see from my background, I have a pretty extensive background in safety as well as in ambulance crashes, by the way. Here is my best friend, Bernie. Those who don't know him, Bernie's in training to be a therapy dog, so he didn't make it to EMS today. He doesn't like to fly other than first class, so I really couldn't bring him with me, but he is my pal, and you'll hear a lot more about him. If you get a chance, go on YouTube and just type in Bernie, the Bernese Mountain Dog, and you'll see how he retrieves medical devices and other things. He's quite an animal. By way of background, I've been involved in EMS for a long time, 19 years in Eastern Pennsylvania as an EMS director and 17 years with GEMS, and I've been involved with some high performance and volunteer ambulance services and spent a lot of my time in the Pennsylvania area and then moved out to the West Coast at the request of Jim Page, a great mentor and friend. EMS Today has over 140 really cutting edge educational sessions. There's some pretty interesting things. There's from the most obscure to Walt Stoy, for example, from the University of Pittsburgh, is going to use nothing but fruits and vegetables to teach educators how to teach their students with a piece of celery about a fractured extremity. So look for some webcasts and things to follow because we're going to expand that education out after EMS today. We have people from all 50 states and 24 other countries, and it's a really interesting perspective to have people with all those different thoughts. It's also kind of difficult to put a program together and you have to please everybody, but we try our best to do that. This year, if you see on the right, we have a mobile application that everybody will be able to follow, and what they don't know is going to happen to them is that every hour there's going to be a flash session that's going to pop up on their screen, and it might be Nadine Levick lecturing over in the corner on ambulance safety for 10 minutes or Connie Matera talking on a clinical topic for 10 minutes. So we've entered that internet age and the mobile app age, and I think that'll be a lot of exciting fun. A massive exhibit hall, certainly with two conferences in one. The exhibit hall has expanded. There's 40 new exhibitors and 50 new products that are going to be here at EMS today. So we're really excited about that. And ambulance safety, we've certainly watched through the effort of the national academies and all of the safety systems and people that are involved in safety and all of the accreditation agencies, that there really has been a push that have forced sometimes some stubborn ambulance manufacturers into re-engineering their ambulances and forward-facing seating. And I understand that there's several new vehicles going to be launched here at EMS today, so we'll follow up on that. We also hold a very interesting clinical competition here at EMS today, the Advanced Clinical Skills Competition called the GEMS Games. And this morning we have 14 teams competing. We start them out in a little mini ambulance from ASP. They run through a course which this year is totally electronic. The Laerdal simulation mannequins are going to be all Bluetooth. They'll take the starting mannequin. They won't jump from station to station with separate mannequins. They'll have the same mannequin with them throughout the entire competition of 8 stations. And this year they're going to be confronted with somebody with a severe asthma case who goes into a systole, has to be resuscitated, has to be carried through tunnels and over barriers and with periods of 2 minutes of uninterrupted CPR. And one of the things that we hope we'll show them is just how badly they do CPR on the move. And so that they can see, even though they think that they're perfect at CPR, the difference that that can make. And then they go on to our skills competition on Friday evening, which will be in front of a crowd of about 700 people. So it's really exciting for us. It is a great camaraderie for people. Teams from all over the country in Reno and Japan compete, and they get some really good prizes. The winning team probably gets about $40,000 in prizes that are donated by vendors. So it's a real incentive for them to participate. I'll give you a little look inside my life and inside my my office. This is a picture of my dad, who was an extremely good innovator in ambulance safety, probably responsible for the Mars light and for other devices, backup lights on ambulances that went on when you put the ambulance in reverse. So he truly was my influence. And about the time that I was about ready to enter college, we were starting to not only move from Cadillac ambulances, but look at some new concepts. So he was an innovator here. The Springfield Body Company came out with international travel halls, and I still remember that his fire chief told him that he thought that my dad had put together a Christmas tree, not an ambulance, because he put so many extra red lights on and white lights because of safety, and things like Perlux fog lights and bumper guards and all those kind of things that you would normally not see on an ambulance. So he truly was an innovator, and I'm kind of proud of that. And this long-haired young guy, we moved from one level of travel all to another, and my dad then developed a concept for a ramp on the side of these ambulances so that they could use a stair chair and just take a patient in the side door. So the one door on one side of the ambulance was extended about 6 inches to allow for a wider access and to be able to put the patient inside. I often said it was because they were lazy and they wanted to put a patient inside in a stair chair, but his concept was if we're going to put somebody inside an ambulance in a stair chair, we want to secure him down. So he actually was one of the only ones I've ever seen that you could put a stair chair in and have it completely secured and anchored to the floor, thanks to Ferno, Washington. So Joe Borgraf, if you're on there, this is a really historic photo.
Joe is here.
And speaking of Ferno, the thing we lived by all the time, and we were commenting here, is the Ferno scoop stretcher on the right-hand side. And so there were a lot of concepts that I can really say were built into the ambulances that my dad was involved with, and I learned a lot of very important lessons from him. This is just one photo of probably 100 that I sent to Nadine to take a look at, and I'm kind of a nut for ambulances, and this is part of my ambulance collection. So I have every matchbox that's ever been made, as well as an extensive collection that I have of all vehicles from all over the world. So if you ever come to my office, you'll be able to tell which one is mine versus the others. I don't have framed certificates on the wall because that would take up the space for the toy ambulances. My biggest toy of all, though, is a 1974 Cadillac Criterion that I have restored to its beauty of 1974. It was the year that they decided that ambulances had to be safer, and they were trying to meet the KKK specs. They put the scoop and backboard compartment up on the roof. They took away the windows. They put in a walk-through so you could walk from front to back. And I will honestly say that I don't think there's a better ambulance ever been made for intubation, because from where at the head of that stretcher to the floor is 60 inches so that you could hang an IV bag. But more importantly, when that head of that Inferno stretcher was lowered down, you could have a perfect alignment to intubate a patient. So it's comfortable. My wife and Jim Page's widow, Jane, refused to ride in it every time I bring it to them for a dinner, and they call it the GAT, the god-awful thing, but I love it. And it's equipped to the air. It's got no wasted space in it. It's an extremely comfortable ride, and I made a comment in the 2004, after the Australian team won the first GEMS games, that they were wonderful competitors and that I would be pleased to have any of them treat me. And so they came over to the United States. I had had some knee surgery. They grabbed me, they threw me on the stretcher, and they forced me to ride around Southern California with Australians who drive on the opposite side of the road, mind you. So it's my esteemed pleasure to be welcoming you to EMS today. You have a great cast of characters. When I looked at the speakers for today's event, I thought that it was the Academy Awards, and actually it's really the Safety Summit. So, Nadine, we're going to send it back to you and to everybody online here. Have a great conference, and we'll be playing it on a loop here throughout the conference.
Thank you so much, AJ.
Yes.
It's good to see my fellow countrymen sitting there on the slide, filling up your ambulance there and taking good care of you. Without further ado, I'm going to move on and do a very quick introduction to our activities today. There we go. I think you all know who I am, but I'm Nadine Levick, and I'm an emergency physician. I run and establish the EMS Safety Foundation, and my day job is an ordinary ER doc in New York at Winthrop Hospital. So thanks to AJ. Thank you very much for your time and your presentation this morning, and for your assistance generally in making this happen. That's the booth we have at EMS today. And so for those of you who are going to be attending EMS today, tomorrow or Friday or Saturday, we'll be running reruns of the presentations that you've seen today and have folks there who can answer some questions for you. So we're very grateful for not only the gracious space, but even the flowers that were provided to us by AJ. So a lot's happened since 2009. We've been very fortunate. This is not the first time we've been here at the National Academies. This is our third summit. And a lot has happened in a very small space of time. New perspectives, new technologies, a new focus on generational differences, new vehicles, new platforms, new policies and standards, and some international models. And that's what you're going to hear about today. The first thing I'm going to talk about has got actually nothing to do with directly a sick person or a vehicle, but it's the explosion in the communications technology world. Because without a doubt, this explosion is going to, and already has, had dramatic impact on what we do in healthcare generally, and particularly will have a lot of impact in emergency healthcare. I just want to point out these little blobs here are all different types of communication gadgets. This big blue blob here, that's standard cell phones, and the year they came out is sitting there between the 80s and the 90s. And you can see there's been an exponential rise, but all of a sudden a fall in standard cell phones. And this other blob here, this lighter blue colour, that's smartphones. And they're about to cross right where we are now. The size of the blob is the cost of the device. And you can see other things like the poor old fax machines dying a miserable death. And corded phones, well, some of us don't even remember what they really were. And the reason I'm showing you that is because here we have smartphone navigation devices. And the TRB hold a fabulous meeting where I learn an enormous amount every year. And this is what I learned there. And this is a chart from the DOT that shows really that navigation devices are very new. And the little orange line is factory-fitted stuff. The blue devices are dedicated portable navigation devices. And this huge exponential leap is smartphone navigation devices. We cannot ignore that this is happening. And it seems to be happening in a very specific sort of age group, to be perfectly honest. Those people who are aged probably 18 months to 44 years of age are the heavy users of this technology right now. a lot of the decision makers may own these devices. This is a purchase, not a use. I know people that own smartphones and don't know how to use them, who are often over the age of 40, 44. I'm learning. But what we can see is that there's heavy use of this sort of technology. There is more computing power in a smartphone than there is in a whole vehicle. And we're going to be hearing a lot of information today about how that can be leveraged into optimising efficiency and safety in our emergency services system. This gentleman here belongs to Generation Y, and that's the generation... Yeah. That's the generation that's actively using these technologies with a fluency that our generation, or the generation of over 44s, really hasn't become accustomed to. I had a special opportunity just last week. They had Social Media Week in New York. This chart's a little difficult to see right here, but it maps the development of social media. We had a phenomenal presentation from Ronald Rolfson, who is joining us online. Unfortunately, he fell ill with pneumonia and won't be here. Ronald Rolfson was the one of the EMS folks who was involved with the Oslo bombing and shootings, where the majority of the communication was via social media that completely bypasses in every nation in the world, not just Norway, but here too, almost completely bypasses the EMS system. We're going to be hearing some innovation that's going to try and bring those together shortly. But I want to bring that to our attention. This is a major area of communication that is completely new. The devices that are being used for this form of communication didn't really exist 5 years ago. And the other important thing to remember is the cloud is global. This information is out there in the cloud, and what is in your hand right now is at the same moment in time in someone else's hand, whether you're using Twitter, whether it's Clout, whether it's Google+, whatever. So with that little introduction, because things really have changed, that three-year window has happened dramatically. The TRB mission's still there, and it's still the same. And the focus for the TRB is really to exchange information in an objective, interdisciplinary and multimodal setting, and that's what we're doing today. And we're very fortunate that Emergency Medical Services is well positioned in the TRB as a key theme. And it's thanks to that theme that we've had the hospitality and the support to be able to do a lot of work in a very small window of time. The TRB, even before it had a subcommittee for EMS safety, had produced an excellent report, a guide for enhancing rural emergency medical services. And you're going to hear shortly how we all have an opportunity to advance the state of emergency services with the assistance of the TRB. So the committee, the subcommittee that runs this is the EMS Safety Subcommittee, ANB 10.5, and its goal is to really bridge that gap between what we do and what is known and how to enhance ambulance transport safety through shared knowledge of technical data, and you're going to get a lot of that today. Sort of a fragmentation panacea. It's an independent platform, brings a whole lot of separate pieces together that don't normally have a common platform. Unites very diverse disciplines from ergonomics to automotive safety to culture. And it's focused on technically robust information, and we're going to try and bring you the best that we can get our hands on. And really encompasses all those aspects of transportation, whether it's systems design, human factors, culture, vehicle operations, some air medical interface, hours of service, impaired operators, the design of the road, access and egress to hospitals, and hazards on the highway, and everything in between. I'm pleased to tell you that this year, the TRB ANB 10 subcommittee has an e-tag, and for those of you who are over 44, you may not know what that is, but if you happen to have a smartphone, you can shine it at that screen right now, and it will take your phone to our website page. So that's just one of those fabulous things you can do with your smartphone. And at that page, you'll be able to see some information about our previous summits that we've had in 2008 and 2009, and there's some of the folks in this very room. I sort of feel like I'm in synagogue here. The women are all on the right and the men are all on the left. But anyway, I don't know what happened there. Anyway, there's some links there to the information about those two summits. So what are we going to do today? Well, how do we measure system safety? What metrics drive decision-making? What are the safety hazards that a system faces? How do we balance the system safety of the patient, the provider, and the public? How much should a medic lift? What's a safe speed? How many hours are safe before we're impaired? How many hours of EVOC makes the system safer? Dear Gaynor is going to be helping us with the answers to some of these a little later. What are the cost and risk benefits of simulators? What benchmarks in other industries are relevant to EMS? What are the determinants of system safety? What technologies enhance system safety performance? How do we reach out to all personnel levels, including Generation Y? What strategies work best with reaching out to each of those generations? What are the global best practice models that we should be reaching out for? And how can we translate global interdisciplinary best practice initiatives into North American EMS? Well, I remember those big heavy bricks you could barely lift that were called mobile phones. And I will confess I'm now the proud owner of a Dick Tracy watch phone for $60. A lot's happened 1980s till now where our ability to harness technology to get what we want quickly, easily, cheaply has dramatically changed. Yet in the 1980s, an ambulance looked like that, and how really when we had our last summit in 2009, an ambulance looked like that. But now we're starting to see vehicles like this on the roads, not only in Europe, but also in the United States. This is a vehicle, both of these vehicles you're going to hear a little more about, but this vehicle here is actually from Dallas, Texas. It's a vehicle that's got forward and rear-facing seating and has been built and designed with technical input from automotive engineers, one of whom's in the room, and ergonomists, one who's online. So we had an opportunity just in January to present this work at the NAMSP conference. And those of you who are in Baltimore, that poster's hanging up in the wall behind you. So anyone in Baltimore can go and have a look at all that work. It's sitting there right in the booth at EMS today. And also we're going to be hearing a little today about some alternative vehicles. And this is a study done in Singapore, which Dr. Mensah will be mentioning, where motorcycles were being used to improve outcomes, not only response times, but actually improve outcomes. And last year, we had the second major motorcycle EMS Congress ever held in the world. So we're seeing big changes. We're also seeing rules and policies addressing known hazards. The Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, November 2011, now has a rule regarding cell phone use and motor vehicle carriers. We're going to look at that in a little more detail. And an hours of service rule in December 2011. Things are really happening. Oh, and here it is. Here's the final rule for handheld cell phone bans. And here's the December new hours of service document. We've had some new fleet standards roll out. ISO 39001, we're going to talk about a little later. That's a general road safety standard that's going to be released in December 2012, this year. ANSI Z15 is out there, and we're hearing wonderful rumblings of maybe doing an EMS version of the Z15, which I think would be a great contribution to optimising system safety. There's a lot of work you'll be hearing shortly about the developing NFPA 1917 standard, and that's being a blend of the Triple-K and AMD documents. We'll hear more about later. And there's a new standard for equipment mounting and testing. And what we're going to try and sort out is what's the difference between testing equipment mounts and actually testing a vehicle. Sure, the automotive engineers know the difference between those things, but a vehicle crashworthiness standard is a very different animal from an equipment mount and testing standard. Okay, we've got some new national, international platforms. Amazingly, almost as rapidly as the smartphones were developed, the NAMT developed a safety course that has exploded with similar popularity and a much better price. And now not only are places throughout, and you'll be hearing about that, I won't steal any of Glenn's thunder, but places throughout the United States and North America, but also Europe. There's the ASEP Safety Culture Project you'll be hearing a few words about from Eileen, and a number of projects coming from a collaboration between the Department of Homeland Security, NIOSH and NIST. Also, the little EMS Safety Foundation's Innovation Consortium is now responsible for a number of truly innovative fleets of vehicles throughout North America and also in Europe, and some of that has been due to the opportunities to share ideas with colleagues at major events like Retmobile, and a number of people have been to Germany to do just that. And that is a, I suppose, sort of like EMS Woodstock, really. About 20,000 people all go to one place and have a very interesting time, and all focused around innovation in emergency response. So no longer are the manufacturers left holding the baby. There now are many opportunities, and that is an ambulance manufacturer holding a baby just yesterday. There now are many opportunities for interdisciplinary collaboration. And I think a lot has happened in 3 years, not just in the cell phone communication industry, but I think we've seen an enormous amount of growth and development and innovation and collaboration across disciplines, across agencies, and amongst individuals. So without any further ado, I would like to hand over to Eileen Fraser, who's going to speak for a few moments about research needs and how we now have an opportunity under this umbrella of the TRB to advance areas of need. And everybody can participate in this. In the room, there's going to be some forms passed out. These forms will be made available also during EMS Today. So if folks at EMS Today would like to contribute research ideas, that opportunity will be there for them also. And there'll be a web portal for them to submit those ideas. So, Eileen, over to you. Oh, you need to talk into a microphone. That one.
We'd like to take this opportunity. What you're seeing and what Rick Payne is passing out is just a simple research needs statement form. As you listen today and reflect about the needs of research, we'd like you to jot down what your thoughts are, put your name at the bottom and contact information, and pass those back to us at the end of the day. Hopefully we can get a good collection of your thoughts here by the day's end.
Well, I'm pleased to say some social media is being used, and we're getting some text messages from folks who are actually at EMS today who are watching this broadcast. So keep the text messages going, and feel free to use Twitter. We're ready to move on to our next section. We've got a very tight schedule. And the next presentation is a safety data update. Would you like me to do it from my laptop? We're just setting up the next set of presentations. Does anyone have any questions from the EMS Today site? I think there's a couple of people there who are actually over there watching our presentation from that particular venue, which is quite interesting. All right, the next presentation block is on data and recent initiatives, and I'd like if the speakers who are involved in that block could all seat themselves right at the front here, so we'll be able to line them up, ready to rock and roll for the next section. All right. Oh. How do I pass it to you? I got it. I'll do this first. Okay. All right. We're ready to move on to our next section, and Charlene Cobb will be moderating this section. Charlene Cobb is a veteran of Retmobile. She's actually been involved in the RetMobile program and with the EMS Safety Foundation for some time. And she's going to be presenting something shortly for us, but for the moment she's going to be our moderator for our data and recent initiatives session. And over to you.
Well, good morning, everybody. The first person that I'd like to introduce to you is going to be Nadine. Are you speaking first? Nadine Levick's going to be speaking on safety data updates.
All right. Yeah, we've had some interesting developments, but we're going to whiz through this very quickly, hopefully. Doesn't want me to change my slides. Okay. Could you flip to the next slide? It's good? Okay. Oh, great. Remember, I'm of that generation that's over 44. Okay. So I'm just going to do a very quick summary of some of the new safety data that's out there. Very, very brief summary. And we'll be inviting some of the folks who've been involved in capturing some of this data for us up to the podium. So the first thing I want to mention very quickly is some of the information that's come through at the TRB, a number of national programs that are underway, and identify some other resources. So the first is a very interesting paper that was presented at the Transportation Research Board annual conference this year, and it was looking at the effects of drivers' action on the severity of emergency vehicle collisions. And it was actually a Canadian study, although it seems to have been conducted by someone from Australia. But it did identify a number of areas where there are there's scope for minimising risk and hazard. The other document that came out very recently, it was a draft in December 2011, is the National EMS Assessment Document. And really, for the first time, we've got a large volume of denominator data. One of our biggest challenges in EMS systems and operational safety is having denominator data. This is a huge leap forwards and an extremely valuable document. We do have some folks from NHTSA here, so if you have any questions about that document, I'm sure they'd be happy to field those. The other document that came down in end of last year in November is the NFPA Data Systems Analysis document. And this is really a comprehensive, big picture look at what data systems are out there. It actually wasn't an analytical look at the quality of the data, but at least it was a big picture look that gave us some information of where data might come from. The other valuable initiative that's been underway since our last summit is the TZD, which was the Towards Zero Deaths EMS initiatives, to try and identify how to optimise the system for EMS to get the best outcome possible for road fatality outcomes. And there's a document there. And that's all being fed into the NCHRP, the National Cooperative Highway Research Program 1751. And a number of folks within the EMS community have contributed to the information being put into the NCHRP 1751, which is really a framework of bringing stakeholders together so that we can have the best possible strategic safety plans for our highways. So again, another new initiative that's unfolded recently. I put this chart up because I just wanted to highlight that a lot of our information is based on data that we do need to be looking analytically at. And this is the FARS, the Fatal Analysis Reporting System data on looking at EMS fatalities related to EMS crashes. And I think one of the things that this highlights is this data system was not designed to look at that outcome. And so the data is a little patchy and it's a little scant. And although we think of FARS as national data, it's really state data that's compiled to look as a national data set. And all these states that are in the white here, they have no data that contributes to the system. So there's about 20% of states didn't actually have data that was capturable to put into FARS. So I think that one of the important things when we start looking at the data now is to identify its strengths and weaknesses. One of the other bits of good news is there's going to be a revision. We've talked about the MUC, the Model Minimum Uniform Crash Criteria. Only an engineer can have come up with that acronym. Someone said to me the other day at the TRB conference, how do you recognise an extroverted engineer? And they said, he's the one looking at someone else's shoes. Anyway. sorry about that. Anyway, so there's going to be some revisions of the EMS-relevant definitions and fields in the forthcoming edition of MUC. And I think the mere fact that we have some affinity with understanding what the MUC is and how important that is, if a definition is not as it should be, the data then will not be as it should be. So it's been great to see the development in that area. And again, NEMSIS has captured more and more data and is more and more robust and is able to provide more and more information that's going to be of value to us. But without further ado, I would like to hand over to the people who've got the really good data. And over to you, Charlene, to introduce our next speaker from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, who's got new data and more comprehensive data. Oh, and we did have our little discussion about research questions. Oh, so in summary, we've got more robust data systems and data mining is really underway now in the area of EMS safety. We still need more information regarding ambulance transport safety, enhanced definitions, better population-based data capture, detailed injury data with mechanisms, and also info on things like wake crashes. We don't have info on that. And we need to be considering a path really optimising the TRB research need statements, which are those research questions there. So thank you. Without further ado.
Well, thank you, Nadine. I'd like to introduce to you Janice Windau from the Department of Labour Statistics. She's going to be speaking to you on statistics and data.
How do I...
It's the one about six from the bottom.
Yeah, hi. Do I have the control of it or do you? Oh, she does. Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, this is an outline of my presentation. First, I'll discuss the census of fatal occupational injuries. I'll go over the description of the data, the timeline, the recent counts for fatalities among EMTs and paramedics, and then I'll discuss the type of event where these workers were injured. And then I'll discuss mainly the same types of information from our survey of occupational injuries and illnesses, which is our non-fatal data. And let's get to it. Our census of fatal occupational injuries covers all work-related fatal injuries in the United States. It includes both public and private sectors, wage and salary workers, self-employed, and volunteers. And notice this just includes fatal injuries. We do not include things like heart attacks or cancers that occur over a period of time. We collect these data from a variety of data sources. We collect them from death certificates, workers' comp reports, media reports. We collect them from NIOSH's database on firefighter fatalities and various other data sources. And we include both information about the incident and also demographic characteristics of the workers. This is our data for EMTs and paramedics from 2003 to 2010. And notice that our data for 2010 are just preliminary right now. We'll be updating the data in April, I believe. And included in these data are those workers whose occupation was reported as EMTs or paramedics. It may exclude firefighters and ambulance drivers whose were working temporarily as an EMT, but whose occupation was not, regular occupation was not an EMS worker. And as you can see, it varies a lot. I don't remember what happened in 2004. That might have been a couple of helicopter crashes or air crashes. This chart shows the type of event where these workers were fatally injured. About 80% were various types of transportation incidents, aircraft crashes, and highway incidents, each comprised about a third of the fatalities. And then another 7% were incurred by being struck by a motor vehicle. And other transportation incidents accounted for another 7%, and assaults and violent acts. That includes both homicides and suicides on the job that comprised 8%. This describes our survey of occupational injuries and illnesses, our non-fatal data. This does include illnesses, but we do recognize that the long-term illnesses are underreported. It's difficult sometimes for the employer to get information after a period of time. These data are obtained from our establishment survey, which is based on OSHA record-keeping logs. The data prior to 2008 cover private wage and salary workers only, and it does exclude volunteers except compensated. Starting with the 2008 data and beyond, we do include state and local government workers that are paid. Volunteers are still excluded unless compensated. And our case and demographic characteristics are only available currently for cases with days away from work. We do have a pilot study going on right now to collect these type of characteristics for days with restricted work activity. Here's a chart from our data from 2008 to 2010. This includes both public and private sectors, like I said. We still do exclude federal government workers, which probably doesn't matter for the study of EMTs and paramedics. And you can see it does vary within those years. This chart again shows the types of events responsible for these injuries. 56% of the injuries were incurred by overexertion types of incidents while they were lifting, for example, or pushing or pulling either the objects or among EMTs, a lot of times patients, both on and off the stretchers. And in comparison to other occupations, overexertion injuries accounted for 23% of all the private and state and local government workers. Bodily reaction types of injuries and illnesses accounted for another 11%. These are incidents in which the worker was either reaching or doing some other type of activity, but not involving another object. And it also includes slips and trips without falls. Falls both on the same level and to lower levels accounted for 9% of these injuries and illnesses, and transportation incidents accounted for 8%. This chart shows the distribution of days away from work among the EMTs and paramedics in 2010. The median days away from work for this occupation was 6 days away from work. The median is basically the midpoint where half of the cases were over 6 days and half of the day, about half were under. And the median days for all private and state local government workers is 8 days away from work during 2010. And here's my contact information if you want to have additional data. We do have additional data.
Okay. Thank you very much, Janice. Our next presenter is going to be Eileen Frazier from the NTSB. NMSAC, NIST, and NHS updates.
About halfway down.
Right there.
That one. Okay. Okay, some of our federal partners couldn't be with us today, so I'm going to try to sort of eclipse what's going on with those agencies. The NTSB, as you know, investigates aviation, marine, train, and highway accidents. But there's nothing specific to ambulance accidents. The reason this is important is with aviation, with particularly helicopter and airplane EMS accidents, I can tell you exactly when they occurred, what type of aircraft, what the pilot was doing 24, 72 hours before. It's very exacting information. We get a preliminary report within 1 to 2 days of the accident. This is all available on the NTSB.gov website. If we had this sort of information for ground ambulance accidents, it would be incredibly helpful to learn what is going on in our industry. That's the NTSB.gov website for curiosity. If you'd like to go on there and see what I'm talking about, you can find the NTSB preliminary reports, like I say, within a day or two of an accident. Within about a year, it's been running a year to a year and a half now, the NTSB will come up with probable causes, and they'll list specifically what those causes were for the accident. It's all done scientifically with all their researchers, so it's really great information. Now, with the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA became part of that, the DHS, in March of 2003. And I wanted to talk about FEMA a little bit. One of our physicians here is part of a working group that I'm also on. We have put together some resource guides. Some of these groups, as you see them listed, they're search and rescue, animal rescue, EMS, and aviation management working groups. These are groups that get together and try to define what our needs are to the next time we have a disaster situation, so that the public knows where to go and what information they need and how to get it. With Katrina, what happened with the aviation part of it was many private helicopters, you know, in all good faith, were responding when they weren't really needed, or they actually made things worse because we had people flying in and out and no one knew what was going on. So what we're trying to do is develop a resource guide typing type thing so that you go through a central location, you tell them what you need as far as patient care, evacuation, and also the type of aircraft, whether you need a helicopter, whether you need a airplane, and what type of people you need on those aircraft. If you need to evacuate a hospital, for example, neonatal unit or cardiac unit, you're going to want to have critical care, we call them specialty care, and the type resourcing type people to do that. If you just need walking wounded evacuated, then you may only need BLS type personnel. So that's what we're working to develop. We've been doing this for several years, and hopefully we'll have something out there soon. Right, Carol? We hope so. Okay. DHS, NIST, NIOSH, they're working on safer ambulance designs. Unfortunately, there wasn't anybody here with us today to go into further information on that, but keep your eye on the websites there, and they'll be able to help you. A recent survey on NIST and NIOSH, Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology Directorate, Human Factors and Behavioral Sciences Division is teaming with NIST and NIOSH, and they will be with us later on this afternoon. If you have any questions, you can talk to, I believe, Jennifer Marshall will be here later this afternoon. NEMSAC, in 2007, it was formalized to serve as an ongoing forum to provide NHTSA and the DOT advice and recommendations from non-government organizations. And one of the designated NEMSAC committees is safety. You can see them at wwems.gov. They follow a very specific process. The committee drafts advisories that are then reviewed by the full NEMSAC in public sessions until their final approval. And according to Daniel Patterson, who has forwarded some information for us today, some of the recent issues that NEMSAC is discussing are things like intersection of leadership and safety culture, emergency vehicle operator education training and safety, fleet fatigue management, and the role of crew resource management in EMS. So in the next couple years, they're going to be addressing mostly fatigue management, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, and CRM in EMS, and I'll also discuss that a little bit later. The CDC published guidelines for field triage of injured patients in 2009, and the goal of this process is to ensure that the injured patients are taken to the most appropriate facility in a timely manner. In 2011, the expert panel reconvened to evaluate new evidence and examine the criteria. The guidelines include things like physiologic criteria, anatomic criteria, mechanism of injury, and special considerations. And you can see the latest draft on the CDC.gov website. So in summary, there are various agencies within the federal government working on EMS issues that provide our EMS people with the opportunity to comment, participate, and communicate. It's important that these agencies work together so that we do not waste valuable time and resources in addressing the future of EMS.
Thank you. Thank you, Eileen. The next person I'd like to introduce to you is the chair of the NAEMT safety course, Mr. Glenn Lukey, and he's also a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, who I work with on that committee.
Down, down, down. About eight or nine from the bottom. Says Ludke, really weird spelling. Whoop! Down, down. There. One more. There you go. I can go over. Ah, there we go. Okay, it works. Good morning, everyone. I'm here to briefly, very briefly, speak about the EMS safety course that NAEMT has put together. In November of 2009, the National Association of EMTs put out a request for people who might be interested in putting together a safety program, recognizing that that this is indeed a dangerous profession and has not previously been recognized very much as such. And they kind of scoured the country for people who were interested in doing that, and this is the group that we came up with, including my colleague to the left, Charlene, and really seven of us from a variety of backgrounds, a variety of different types of practice, all of whom have an interest in EMS safety. And we were charged with developing a course that would meet certain criteria. First of all, we wanted it to be a one-day program so that it would be easy for organizations to put on without having to worry about maintaining people overnight, providing accommodations for overnight stays and things like that. But something that you could accomplish within one day. We decided on an interactive format, obviously, with lecture, discussion, group activities, those sorts of things. And to the extent possible, we used case studies, real case studies, things that had actually happened, to illustrate our points, because we know that adults learn best from that sort of material. We submitted the final draft to CSBEAMS, the accrediting organization, and the program was awarded 8 hours of continuing education credit, so that individuals who took the course could actually could use that credit toward their recertification, which is a concern with educators in EMS, putting on programs that people can use for those purposes. We constructed the course in 8 modules, and you'll notice Eileen talked about crew resource management, and right after the introduction, the first thing up is crew resource management, which we really, as the course developed, became the linchpin for everything else that the course had to offer. It's something that we stole from the airline industry. The fire service was already in the process of using it, and we found that it worked very well for emergency medical services, and really used that as the jumping off point for everything else that comes afterwards: emergency vehicle safety, scene operations, which has mostly to do with roadway operating in the roadways, patient handling, provider, patient, and bystander safety of the individual in a variety of situations, personal health, and then finally the program concludes. We rolled the program out at EMS Today last year in March of 2011. Since that time, we've done 11 state and national courses and 214 local and regional courses. To date, we've trained 1,445 persons, which we're really pleased with that kind of number. And we really concentrated, keeping in mind that the first courses were the seven of us from the group going out and training people and training them to be instructors for the rest of the course. We've been able in a year to certify 401 instructors to carry the course forward and present that course in their own communities. We have programs that are active right now in 30 states, and we're going to be, I'll talk about where we're going from there. In addition, we've gone international. In December, it was my privilege to go to Tokyo, Japan, to roll out a course there. We found that the paramedics in Japan were most interested in this. One of their representatives attended the EMS Expo and took the course there and wanted very much to bring it back to his country. They translated all of the materials. The workbook, the slides, subtitles for the videos, everything into Japanese, and I was privileged to go over and help them put on their first course in December, which went very well. And now we trained those folks as instructors, and now they're carrying it forth. And their goal is to train all of the providers in the country. We're in contact right now with a couple of other organizations, an organization in Tel Aviv, Israel, which is. Which has signed an agreement and is about to initiate the course there. And we're also talking with Aruba, which is the course that I for sure want to go and do to get them rolled out. And there are others in progress as well. So we're not only expanding nationally, but internationally. Our goals, whoops, let me back up a little bit. Our goals and objectives, we're going to be meeting actually next week at NEMT's headquarters in Mississippi, to see where we want to go from here. And these are among our goals and objectives: to establish courses in the remaining 20 states within the United States, as well as expanding our international program. And we'll actually begin the revision process. This EMS safety right now, as I think everyone in the room recognizes, is a moving target. There are developments every day that change the way that we look at things. So we're going to start that revision process, talk about how we want to get it started next week, and then we'll get started on that. We are also involved in the EMS Culture of Safety Project, which you'll hear more about later, and we'll continue our activities there, as well as our continued collaboration with the EMS Safety Foundation. So if anyone wants information about the course, I'll be in the room all day. For those of you who are at EMS today, I'll be up there on Friday. I'll be pretty easy to find. Or otherwise, you can email me or send an email to the National Association of EMTs, and they'll get the word to me, and we'll help you out because we really want to spread this thing. So thank you for the opportunity to tell everybody about this program. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Glenn, for getting up and speaking about that. The next moderator, actually, is going to be Carol Cunningham, and she's going to be introducing transport, human factors, and bridging diverse disciplines. Carol?
Good morning. This section here is on transport, human factors, and bridging diverse disciplines. And we'll. Oh, you can't. Can you hear me? Okay. Need to move this. Sorry. And first speaker will be on safety culture, culture of change. We'll bring Eileen Frazier back.
Right there. You got it. Okay. Well, culture and fatigue are kind of buzzwords today. We've been at the Commission on Accreditation, we've been looking at fatigue and culture for the last several years very extensively. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about what is culture. It's the way we do things around here. Organizational culture is defined by its mission, vision, and values. And remember that word values, because that enters very importantly into culture. Organizational safety culture. There's something wrong here. Hold on a minute. Okay, it's how we work together as managers and employees to achieve the organizational goals and expectations in a cohesive, safe, and progressive manner. The key elements of organizational safety culture are 4 points, and I'll talk to each of these. An informed culture, a just culture, a flexible culture, and a learning culture. And it's not moving. Okay. I love this graph. It was done by Yoshida and Suishi back in 1989. He called it the information iceberg. And what they did was they went around and talked to many, many industries and companies and tried to find out exactly who knew what about the problems within the organization. And so when you look at this, you can see that the problems known to workers is 100%. So the people actually doing the work, 100% of those problems are known to the workers. The problems known to supervisors, only 74%. As you go up the line to top management, problems known to middle management, 9%. Problems known to top management, only 4%. So if you're in any one of those categories, you will quickly learn how much you really know about what's happening in your organization. And why is this important? It's not moving ahead. Maybe my battery's dead. Nope. Next one. Okay. Informed culture is dependent on reporting hazards, so the obligation to report or disclose, discuss, and learn seems to be the critical hinge around which we believe a just culture should work. This was a quote from Sidney Decker. If you've ever read a book about just culture, you need to pick up Just Culture by Sidney Decker. It's a wonderful book, and it really brings a lot of thought-provoking aspects to this. Dr. Lucian Leap, the professor at Harvard, in his testimony before Congress on healthcare quality improvement, said healthcare providers report only what they cannot hide. Why is medical error important? Because it's the greatest risk for demise in the United States, not roadway deaths. For 4 to 5 deaths are due to medical error for each roadway death. David Marks found this in his 2009 study. So what is a just culture? People mistake this for a safety culture. It really is a way to manage so that you have a safe culture. It's a value-supported system of shared accountability where organizations are accountable for the systems they have designed and responding to the behaviors of their staff in a fair and just manner. How many times have you heard of a medical error or mistake made and the person that made it is fired or let go? Human errors are part of our human being process. We acknowledge that we have human fallibility. Just culture focuses on system design and the behavioral choices, not the errors and adverse outcomes. Defines fair and just responses to behavioral choices and defines our duties. So what is it? It recognizes that we're fallible, yet we do have control of the systems in which we work. We do control our behavioral choices. We must be cognizant of the risk around us, and we must participate in a learning culture. We must make choices that align with our values. There's that word, values. And we can improve. Then I want to talk about flexible culture and adaption to change. Culture is never stagnant, and therefore we need constant attention to the changes and ways to measure response to change. So be alert to generational changes and differences. It's very interesting. We do a safety culture survey as we go out and do accreditation site visits. We get the email for each one of the staff, and we send the survey out, and then it's returned to us anonymously, and we can look at the data from the safety culture survey, and also, more importantly, the comments that people are often afraid to make to their personnel, to their leaders, to their management. And so it's a very interesting process. But I did send this out to an organization that had over 400 ambulances. And the manager called me and he said, "You can't be serious. You want people to answer this by email?" He said, "It's never going to happen. I have 20-year-olds, mostly 20-year-olds on my staff. And what they want to do is send things by Twitter or look at Facebook. They are not going to answer any emails." So you have to be constantly aware of those generational differences. And then learning culture. We need a willingness and competence to draw the right conclusions from the safety information systems and the will to implement reforms when the need's indicated. How do you do that? Well, you look at your key organizational metrics, the data, track and trend it, and learn from the data about safety, quality, and organizational improvement. To assess culture, you can use things like a safety culture survey. By the way, the one I talked about, we have on our website. You can download it at camts.org and use it, you know, if you want to use it for your own people and see what happens. Usually it's better if an outside agency does the safety culture, but if it's anonymous, you may glean a lot of things from that. Has your culture evolved to support your values and expectations? Have you developed a learning culture to optimize performance? Are your employees aware of the role of their behavioral choices within the system? The American College of Emergency Physicians is helping with this EMS Culture of Safety project. DIA is part of this. The project's being produced under the cooperative agreement with the NHTSA, HRSA, and EMSC, and, of course, ASAP. And recognizing that patient safety in the EMS setting has been poorly studied, with little data and limited trials of interventions designed to make EMS safer, this study is in its second draft now. Unfortunately, the public comment for the second draft has passed, but I understand the next public comment will be in May of 2012. Please look this up on www.emsculturesafety.org. I spoke about Cindy Decker a little while ago in his book on Just Culture. James Reason is also an excellent reference for the Human Contribution book and other writings he's done, mostly geared to aviation, but we learn a lot from aviation. Also, in summer of 2012, Ashgate will publish a CAMES reference, and it's entitled Safety and Quality in Medical Transport Systems, Creating an Effective Culture. We have about 26 invited guest authors who are experienced human factors scientists from SMS world and from designs in how to do risk analysis. All these people have written for us, and that book should be published in summer of 2012, so look for that.
Thank you. I'm just going to have a brief interruption in our enthusiasm to move forwards with the program. We actually have organized for this program to be recorded in blocks. And there was a little question period that we'd like to...